I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, there's more news today about the U.S. economy, which will get another $800 billion from the government. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson announced two new plans. One involves the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department spending $200 billion to ease lending on debt such as credit cards, auto, and student loans. Paulson called that a starting point. He also said the Fed will buy up to as much as $600 billion in mortgage-backed securities. $100 billion will go to direct obligations from mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, another $500 billion for mortgage-backed securities. Here's Treasury Secretary Paulson.
It will take time to work through the difficulties in our market and our economy, and new challenges will continue to arise. I and my regulatory colleagues are committed to using all the tools at our disposal to preserve the strength of our financial institutions and stabilize our financial markets to minimize the spillover into the rest of the economy.
A short time after Treasury Secretary Paulson spoke, President-elect Barack Obama held his second news conference in as many days, announcing the new members of his economic team. Peter Orszag will be his budget director. Orszag is currently director of the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. Obama also named Robert Neighbors as deputy budget director. Neighbors has been the top staff aide on the House Appropriations Committee. And the president-elect said there will be deep spending cuts, significant budget reform, and he spoke of his plan to create 2.5 million new jobs.
But if we are going to make the investments we need, we also have to be willing to shed the spending that we don't need. In these challenging times, when we're facing both rising deficits and a shrinking economy, budget reform is not an option. It's a necessity. We can't sustain a system that bleeds billions of taxpayer dollars on programs that have outlived their usefulness or exist solely because of the power of politicians, lobbyists, or interest groups. We simply can't afford it. This isn't about big government or small government. It's about building a smarter government that focuses on what works. And that's why I will ask my new team to think anew and act anew to meet our new challenges. We are going to go through our federal budget, as I promised during the campaign, page by page, line by line, eliminating those programs we don't need and insisting that those that we do need operate in a sensible, cost-effective way. Let me just give you one example of what I'm talking about. There's a report today that from 2003 to 2006, millionaire farmers received $49 million in crop subsidies, even though they were earning more than the $2.5 million cutoff for such subsidies. Now, this is true, and this was just a report this morning, but if it's true, it is a prime example of the kind of waste that I intend to end as president. We're also going to focus on one of the biggest long-run challenges that our budget faces, namely the rising cost of health care in both the public and private sectors. This is not just a challenge, but also an opportunity to improve the health care that Americans rely on and to bring down the costs that taxpayers, businesses, and families have to pay. Now, that's what the Office of Management and Budget will do in my administration. It will not only help design a budget and manage its implementation, but it's also going to make sure that our government, your government, is more efficient and more effective at serving the American people. There's no better person to help lead this effort as director of the OMB than my friend Peter Orszag. Peter's been one of our nation's leading voices on budgetary issues. It's said that a nation's budget reflects its values and its priorities. I believe that's true, and I know that Peter will bring to his work at the OMB a set of priorities that I and the American people share. Throughout his career, he's made significant contributions in our understanding of all the major economic challenges that we're now confronting, from reducing medical costs to saving Social Security, to fighting global climate change, to helping put the dream of a college degree within the reach of more students. As director of the Congressional Budget Office, he re-energized and reinvigorated the agency while shifting its focus to confront the health care crisis that is not only a cause of so much suffering for so many families, but a rapidly growing portion of our budget and a drag on our entire economy. But it's not simply that Peter's past career makes him qualified for this new appointment. It's also that he has a vision for the future that I share. He believes, as I do, that even as we take steps to restore discipline to our budget, we also have to take the steps right now that are necessary to solve our immediate crisis. Peter doesn't need a map to tell him where the bodies are buried in the federal budget. He knows what works and what doesn't, what's worthy of our precious tax dollars and what is not. Just because a program, a special interest tax break, or corporate subsidy is hidden in this year's budget does not mean that it will survive the next. The old ways of Washington simply can't meet the challenges of today and tomorrow. And no one's more able or more qualified to assist Peter in this work than Deputy Director of the OMB that I am nominating, Robert Nabors. Rob will bring to this post experience in the executive branch at the OMB, where he helped the Clinton administration achieve balanced budgets, as well as in the legislative branch, where he led the Appropriations Committee staff as a driving force for a responsible budget.
That's President-elect Obama speaking at a news conference in Chicago today. He was also asked what kind of a mandate he thinks he has following the election. Let's listen to more.
First of all, we had, I think, a decisive win because of the extraordinary desire for change on the part of the American people. And so I don't think that there's any question that we have a mandate to move the country in a new direction and not continue the same old practices that have gotten us into the fix that we're in. But I won 53% of the vote. That means 46 or 47% of the country voted for John McCain. And it's important, as I said on election night, that we enter into the new administration with a sense of humility and a recognition that wisdom is not the monopoly of any one party. In order for us to be effective, given the scope and the scale of the challenges that we face, Republicans and Democrats are going to have to work together. And I think what the American people want more than anything is just common sense, smart government. They don't want ideology. They don't want bickering. They don't want sniping. They want action, and they want effectiveness. And that's what Peter and Rob are going to help us provide. When it comes to our budget, I think people don't want to continue a budget, an argument about big government or small government. They want smart government and effective government. And so what we're going to do is to work as closely as we can with the Republican Party. My chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, has already met with both caucuses. We want their input. We want their ideas.
That's President-elect Barack Obama speaking about the economy and the need to cut government spending. Well, Greg Ipp is with The Economist magazine. I asked Greg if we've learned more about where those cuts might come from.
I don't think we got a lot in terms of substantive content about the direction he plans to go in. I mean, he sort of sounded all the right notes about fiscal responsibility and cutting wasteful spending, but we didn't hear anything specific about how big that fiscal stimulus plan is that he's talked about in order to save 2.5 million jobs. And more important, he hasn't sketched out any sort of vision about how he's going to bring the budget back to some sort of sustainable balance after we're through this recession, when the deficit will obviously be quite a bit larger. You know, that's a pretty big burden that's going to be resting on the shoulders of Peter Orszag, the new budget director, which is to, on the one hand, accommodate the increased spending and lower taxes that will be part of battling the recession, but sketch out a long-range plan dealing not just with the collapse in revenues that we're experiencing as a consequence of these events, but the big surge in spending we're going to get from baby boomers as they retire.
We did hear about reducing health care costs, though, and criticism of crop subsidies to farmers. Do you think we'll see immediate action on those issues in particular?
Possibly, but a couple things on that. First of all, on health care, I think President-elect Obama envisions reducing costs in health care as part of an overall scheme that would expand or could significantly reform the system so that lower-income people would have much better access to health care Medicaid would be made a bit more generous. So while there may be ways in the context of doing that to reduce some spending and waste, I think at the end you'd still end up with a larger health care expenditure. That might be a worthwhile goal because you are insuring more people, but it's hard to see how on net you end up spending less money. And as to the crop program and other things like that, first of all, you might have a battle with key constituencies in Congress, and second of all, the sums involved are not large relative to the overall budget.
Okay. And Gail Shattuck, she's Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She's also on the line, and she's been listening to the President-elect's press conference today. And Gail, we heard this announcement from the President-elect today about some more of his economic advisors and what action he plans to take. What do you think is the main message that we should take from this news conference today from President-elect Obama?
Well, I think he is clearly reaching out to Republicans as well as Democrats. You know, we're used to hearing a lot of bipartisan talk in advance of any Congress, but I think that this actually could have some legs and some consequences. His mentioning that he won by 53% and that while a mandate to move in a new direction, is also a cause for humility. And the line that will be remembered the most is that given the scope and scale of the problems we face, we need to work in a bipartisan way. You know, with almost 60 votes and a dramatically higher majority in the House, he may have the numbers he needs to push something, but he's calling for something more here. He's calling for a kind of political, even moral authority for moving forward in very, very difficult times. And I that's what's so striking to me about the impact he's already having on the Hill, the concrete efforts to speak directly to Republicans, all that language about the budget, where are the bodies buried, not big government, not small government, but smart government, what actually works, let's get rid of things that don't. That just warms the hearts, not only of conservative Democrats who have come back in greater strength, but also of conservative Republicans.
Mm-hmm. And let's say that this press conference on the part of the President-elect comes after Treasury Secretary Paulson outlined two new plans today in the continuing effort to unfreeze credit markets. One involves the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department spending about $200 billion to ease commercial lending, and another one is spending as much as $600 billion for mortgage-backed securities. Greg, I'm wondering, when we look at these two plans, they sound similar to what the $700 billion bailout was supposed to be, but is there any difference here?
Oh, actually, there's an important difference, because if you'll recall, what Paulson wanted to originally to do with the $700 billion was to buy impaired assets from banks so that would clean up their balance sheets, enable them to lend again. And then just a matter of weeks later, as the financial crisis got worse, he pivoted and said, no, instead of doing that, we're going to put some money into banks to shore up their capital bases. And what happened as a consequence of that U-turn was that we then saw prices of some of these assets start to deteriorate again. So in some sense, what he announced today was an attempt to tackle the original goal of that program, a goal which had been, in some sense, been abandoned in order to do capital injections into banks. And this is very, very important, especially the decision by the Fed to invest heavily in mortgage-backed securities. It's already had an immediate impact in bringing down the yields in the capital markets on those securities, which will translate to lower mortgage rates.
That's Greg Ipp of The Economist magazine. We also spoke with Gail Chaddock, Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. It's Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Well, this being Thanksgiving week, food is on the mind of many of us. And we have a question. How many food-related decisions do you think you make each day? 10, 20, 100? Try 200, according to Cornell University researcher Brian Wansink, who says that when we're not paying attention, we eat quite a bit. Professor Wansink shares his findings in his book, Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. We spoke with him when his book came out, and in this season of overindulgence, we thought we'd revisit that conversation. We began by asking him, why is it that people don't think about how much they're really eating?
We have way too many things going on in our life to kind of go over the nuances of how many ounces we're pouring or how many bites of macaroni we've had that day. So we've got the distractions of who we're eating with. We've got the distractions of what's going on, whether it be the television set or something we're reading. We also have all the distractions of what we're thinking about all day. And as a result, these 200-plus decisions that we make a day end up being very subtly but very significantly influenced by the little cues around us.
And you also talk about something in the book called the mindless margin. Can you explain that?
The mindless margin is the number of calories that's estimated a typical person can cut out of their day-to-day intake without knowing it psychologically and certainly without knowing it physiologically. And it's estimated that this can be, for most people, at least 300 calories. 300 calories a day doesn't sound like a whole lot, but over the course of a year, if you were to eliminate 200 or 300 calories per day, you'd weigh 20 to 30 pounds less in a year than you otherwise would today. Leaving us to lose weight at the end of the year instead of saying, man, you know, why are my pants even tighter than they were last year?
You also say we have a lot of external cues telling us to eat.
If you talk to most people say that they overeat because they're either really, really hungry or the food's really, really good. We decided to say, hey, look, let's say we take people who are full and give them food that is terrible. And one thing we did is we took people who had just finished eating lunch and who were coming in to see a movie. We gave them either a medium bucket of popcorn or a huge, large bucket of popcorn. But this was five-day-old stale popcorn.
Yuck.
But what we did is we gave them this popcorn, and they take a bite and they just wince because the stuff was terrible. But what we found is that over the course of the movie, people who were given this huge bucket ended up eating 35% more popcorn than those given medium buckets.
And they were full.
Yeah, they were full, and the food was terrible because every cue around you in the movie says, eat, eat, eat. The people next to you, when they crunch away, they say, eat. When you watch the movie, a big part of the script is eating popcorn as you're looking up at the screen. And then the size of the container actually suggests how much to eat.
You know, you had another really interesting experiment about a soup bowl. Can you briefly explain the soup bowl?
Most people say, if you ask them, hey, how do you know your meal's done? They say, hey, well, I know I'm done when, hey, my plate's clean. Or, you know, my soup bowl's empty. We thought, oh, well, what happens if the plate never empties or the soup bowl never empties? And so we created this bottomless soup bowl where we actually drilled a hole in the bottom of the soup bowl and through the bottom of the table and ran this food-grade tubing up, connected to the bottom of the soup bowl, over in this big six-quart cauldron of hot soup. And what happened, we brought invited people in for lunch, and as they ate soup, the level would drop down in the soup bowl, but it would always be refilled to the point where it was at about half full. So after about 20 minutes, we stopped people, and one of the things we found is that they ended up eating 73% more soup in these refill soup bowls. But when we asked them how full they were, they didn't rate themselves as being any more full than the people eating from normal bowls because there was still half a bowl of soup left.
That's
how can they be
amazing.
Full?
So we're really not as smart as we think we are. But, you know, what else I thought was interesting in these experiments is that the folks that you spoke with thought that other people would eat like this and have to finish their soup bowl, but not them.
Even when we show people evidence, they say, well, come on, others might get fooled by this, but not me. And this is what makes this so incredibly dangerous. First of all, these cues are ubiquitous. But second of all, we don't think they're having any impact, which allows them to continue to have the impact that they've had every 2 pounds every year that we've gained over the last 20 years.
Right. And actually, in one instance, you gave a course to students about mindless eating.
Yes.
You told them about the cues, right?
Yeah. I did a 90-minute lecture of graduate students. I showed them how if they eat Chex Mix out of a big bowl, they're going to eat more and why. And I demonstrated it. They discussed it. I showed them videos. I lectured on it. And you know, they were sick of it. When we, 6 weeks later, invited them to a Super Bowl party, either served out of a big bowl of Chex Mix or two smaller bowls of Chex Mix. And even though they knew about this, they ended up eating 53% more.
Right. How much of this might be explained just by the sort of old-fashioned notion that we had to clean our plates?
Well, I mean, I think some people believe so. I think what instead is going on for us is that when we decide how much we want to eat, we estimate how much we're going to eat, and we serve it to ourselves. Instead of taking a bite and saying, am I full yet? Am I full yet? And I think it has less to do with the clean plate club than it does the idea that we're our own best estimator of how hungry we think we are, and we don't want to spend our entire meal, obsessing about whether we're full or not.
Yeah. I know that this is a time of year that a lot of people just eat mindlessly. Obviously, it's the holidays, and we're not thinking, and we're getting together with folks. But I'm wondering, as a food researcher, Brian, do you find yourself mindlessly eating sometimes, especially this time of year? Or have you just done this so much that you're above it all?
Well, everybody mindlessly eats, and if there's any day that you're going to allow yourself to mindlessly eat, it's on these very special holidays that we have. But even for Thanksgiving, for instance, there's some very easy things you can do. And one thing is, you know that you're going to really disappoint a lot of people if you don't eat Aunt Grace's green bean casserole or your grandmother's famous turkey recipe. You know you're going to have to eat all those things. So the key thing to do is just beforehand, don't eat the cheese ball. You know what cheese balls taste like. Just wait for the dinner to start, and that way you can end up going through the entire thing.
That's researcher Brian Wansink. His book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. And we have this update on Professor Wansink. He's currently on leave from Cornell to develop dietary guidelines for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And that soup bowl experiment, well, it was awarded the 2007 Ig Nobel Prize, which recognizes achievements that, quote, first make people laugh and then make them think. We'll be back after the news, here and now. The latest issue of U.S. News & World Report hails Defense Secretary Robert Gates as one of America's best leaders. So, should he stay on as Defense Secretary? Well, there are some in Washington who say that with two wars going on, President-elect Obama may have to ask Gates to remain in his post at least for another year. But others are outraged that Obama might keep the man who, for the past 2 years, has been leading the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then there's Gates himself, who reportedly refers quite often to a small clock on his keychain that counts down to January 20th, 2009, when he might return to his home in Washington State. Dimitri Sevastopoulou is Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times, and he joins us on the line from Washington. And Dimitri, what has Gates or the Obama team said about the possibility of Gates staying on?
Well, no one has said anything publicly, but it's been interesting that over the past few months, Robert Gates's language has changed. Initially, when asked about whether he would stay on, he would say things like, well, it's inconceivable the circumstances under which I would remain in Washington, or I'm looking forward to getting home to the Pacific Northwest. But we traveled to Canada with him last week, and we asked him about it there, and all he will say is no comment.
And at this point, we do know that there are direct negotiations going on between Gates and the Obama team.
That's right. One of the key questions is personnel. Interestingly, when Gates came into the Pentagon and replaced Donald Rumsfeld at the end of 2006, because he had to get into the war in Iraq and the situation in Afghanistan so quickly, he didn't have an opportunity really to bring any of his own people in. So one of the questions that's being sorted through at the moment is, obviously, President-elect Obama will want to have some of his key people in the Pentagon, but this is also an opportunity for Gates to bring in people that he trusts and wants to have as his advisors. And Gates is very respected both abroad and in the U.S. and on Capitol Hill. I mean, you have to say that in the 2 years roughly that he's been in the job, you've barely heard a word of criticism from the Democrats. Clearly, the economic and financial crisis is going to be the first and foremost issue on President-elect Obama's mind when he enters the White House. So in some respects, having Gates maintain his hand on the tiller, doing, by all accounts, a good job, gives Obama a little bit more leeway to concentrate on the issues that are going to be the immediate ones.
And the immediate, at least in terms of national security, will be likely Iraq and Afghanistan. Let's talk about Iraq first. What are the differences, at least the stated differences, between President-elect Obama and Robert Gates on the strategy for when U.S. troops might leave Iraq?
The main difference publicly has been that Obama has called for a timetable. He has said he would withdraw troops or combat troops from Iraq within 16 months of taking office. Both Robert Gates and Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, they don't want to have a defined timetable publicly. But in some ways, this may become moot because the U.S. and the Iraqis have signed a security agreement which requires all U.S. troops to be out of the country by the end of 2011. So I think that the situation is already moving to a place where Robert Gates could conceivably say, well, I'm just implementing a deal that we've signed with the Iraqis, and that happens to coincide with what President Obama wants to do. So I think that can be papered over. And during the campaign, one of the things that President-elect Obama was strongest about was the need to refocus on Afghanistan, to tackle al-Qaeda, and to start putting more resources into the war there.
And the Pentagon is sending more troops to Afghanistan. So are Obama and Gates on the same page, at least in terms of what's needed in Afghanistan?
Yes, they are. Obama has said he would like to send about an additional three brigades, which is roughly kind of 12,000, 13,000, 14,000 troops. And Secretary Gates said to us in Canada last weekend that he would like to fulfill the requests of the commanders on the ground in Afghanistan as quickly as possible. And they are asking for somewhere north of 20,000 troops. The question, though, will be how quickly you can provide those. No one believes that all of those troops are going to be sent into Afghanistan quickly. They need to be troops coming out of Iraq need to be retrained, retooled, re-equipped before they can be sent into Afghanistan.
Mm. You know, as you mentioned, Gates has been on the job for about 2 years after he took over for Donald Rumsfeld.
Yeah.
Rumsfeld known as being extremely abrasive. How would you describe Gates' style?
Gates is the polar opposite. He is not abrasive at all, particularly in public. One of the interesting things he did earlier on in his tenure is where he went to a security conference in Europe, and he basically he kind of repudiated one of Rumsfeld's old phrases, which was old Europe, new Europe, and said publicly, you know, those days are behind us. He's very clever in the public realm. He is good at, I think, managing people. But, I mean, European diplomats say privately that in private, he's just as tough as Rumsfeld. For example, he has been very hard on the Europeans, saying you need to send more troops to Afghanistan. But he does it in a way publicly that makes it easier for them. He's not as in your face as Rumsfeld was. And I think he's also taken that approach to Capitol Hill, where when he deals with senators and congressmen in the House, he's very deferential. He gets his points across. He's firm, but he is very respectful, and I think he has gained kudos for doing that. The other thing he does, which is very different from Rumsfeld, is he apologizes. So when the U.S. mistakenly bombed civilians in Afghanistan, he apologized. And I think the difference is Gates understands that apologizing is a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness, whereas Rumsfeld always thought as a sign of weakness. You should never apologize for something, not for Abu Ghraib, not for Guantanamo or whatever.
Mm-hmm. What area of the world do you think we might see the biggest difference if Defense Secretary Gates stays on in an Obama administration?
I think that will depend more on what happens in the world rather than Gates staying on. The two big questions next year, I would say, for the military are, one, Pakistan, how stable does it remain? This is a nuclear-armed country, which is very unstable at the moment. It's just come to the IMF for an emergency loan to try and get its economy back from the brink. So Pakistan is going to be key to watch. And then the second question will be Iran. And many people think that 2009 is the year that Iran may cross some kind of a red line in terms of developing a nuclear weapons capability. Gates had toned down the rhetoric on Iran during his 2 years. He has emphasized diplomacy, and I think one of the things you will see is Gates pushing for diplomacy on Iran, and that's something that President-elect Obama has talked very strongly about, too. So I think you'll see a meeting of minds there, kind of a pragmatic approach to many of these problems around the world.
Mm. And if not Gates, then who might be the next defense secretary?
If it's not Gates, the other candidates, the other names who've been floated are Chuck Hagel, the Republican senator from Nebraska who is retiring. He's been one choice. Richard Danzig is the former Secretary of the Navy, and he's a key Obama policy advisor on military and foreign affairs. And he has been named as a potential secretary. If Gates stays on, he would more likely be the deputy secretary. I think they're the key names. Senator Jack Reed, the Rhode Island Democrat,
right. Mm-hmm.
Is a possibility. But I think the Democrats at this point, they may want to keep him in the Senate.
And do we have any idea at this point, Dimitri, with all of the turmoil in the economy as to when we might hear about who might be the next defense secretary?
I think what's going to happen is, in the same way that Obama announced his economic team in unison yesterday, I suspect you will have the kind of the national security team. So it would be Defense Secretary, Secretary of State, and National Security Advisor, probably announced on the same day. It looks like it's not going to be this week. My guess, and it's only a guess, is that we would see it next week after Thanksgiving.
All right. Well, Dimitri Sevastopoulou is Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. Dimitri, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Nice to talk with you.
Just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live on our website, here-now.org. And before we go today, the new film remembering the late gay San Francisco City Councilor, Harvey Milk. You're listening to Here and Now. We've been hearing a lot lately about how the economic downturn is hurting retailers, car dealers, charities, restaurants. Well, now add daycare centers to that list. Across the country, daycare providers are reporting falling enrollments as parents pull their kids out to try to save money. The average cost of daycare is between $65 and more than $200 a week. And in Rockford, Illinois, a number of centers are reporting that parents are having trouble keeping up with those costs. Rockford has the highest unemployment rate in Illinois. It jumped to nearly 9% in September. Diane Kesterton is director at New Horizons, a daycare center in Rockford. And Diane, can you tell us, what are your enrollments? What have they been like?
Well, starting in September, we lost the whole classroom. That's 10 children. So we're down to about 32% right now of what we should be at.
And what are parents telling you? Why are they leaving?
Financial. Jobs are ending. And when they can find jobs, it's like $8 or $9 an hour. So they're getting relatives to babysit or working night shifts.
And what about kids at the center? Do they notice these changes when a classroom of 10 kids is gone?
Yes. We're a small center, and these kids are more like brother and sister, so they know who's here and what's going on. And every once in a while, I'll hear someone say, well, I wish I had a play date, or one of the kids' name is Zachary. One of my friends says, well, he was my best friend 3 months ago. Why can't we see him?
Diane, are you hearing stories from the kids about how the slow economy might be affecting them, even if they are still there?
I hear a couple of them say that we couldn't go to McDonald's, Mom didn't have the money, or I wanted to go bowling and Daddy didn't have the money. You know, I'm hearing that.
So how much do you charge? Roughly, what's the average cost for a preschool child?
For a preschool child, we charge $159 a week, but that includes breakfast, lunch, a snack, and a preschool curriculum.
And so are there some parents who maybe are just keeping their kids there because maybe they become attached to some of the other folks there, and they say, well, maybe they can pay late, maybe they can pay half?
We're doing everything in our power to keep as many children here. We're encouraging our parents to go for state-funded assistance. We're helping them if they need to go part-time to keep the children continuity. Some of the ones that are struggling, we tell them to make whatever payment they can. We've had some parents pay late. We're trying to avoid that. But I've had one mother this year come up and say, it's either buy my child a coat or pay you guys. And I'm sitting there saying, pay me next week. Get your child a coat, because it was like going to go into the 30s. And coats come first.
That must be an incredibly difficult line to walk. On the one hand, you become very attached to these families, and at the same time, you're running a business, and you're down by 32%.
That gets very, very hard, because our expenses are going up, being a small center, too. My staff will not get a raise this year.
And we also, it's also my understanding that you had to let one of your aides go this year?
Right, we did. We let her go in September when our numbers started dropping and we couldn't pick up right away.
How long do you think you can continue to operate down 32%?
Right now, if it stays like this, we can stay in business. If it gets much lower, then we'll have to figure out another game plan. But we have no intentions of closing the doors.
You mentioned telling some of your parents to look and see if state-funded assistance was available. We know that about a third of the children who attend your daycare center do have their care paid for by the state. But it's also my understanding that the state is having trouble paying for that.
Right. They were late this month. They usually send us our checks around the 14th or 15th, and it was like the 20th, 21st before we got our checks. It gets kind of scary. But I keep reminding myself we're not the only center in town that's going through this crunch. Every center director I've talked to is going through the same problems.
Well, Diane, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Diane Casterton is director at New Horizons, a daycare center in Rockford, Illinois. She's been talking with us about the center's falling enrollments during this economic downturn. Back in a minute, here and now. It's Here and Now.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
In the new biographical film, Milk, Sean Penn stars as Harvey Milk, the first openly gay man to be elected to public office when he won a seat on San Francisco's Board of Supervisors in 1978. In this scene, Harvey revels in his new office as he greets Cleve Jones, played by Emile Hirsch.
Well, what do you think of my new theater?
Bit over the top.
Unfortunately, Harvey Milk had little time to enjoy his new job. As the film reminds us, he and San Francisco Mayor George Moscone were killed by another elected official, Dan White, later that year. The real Cleve Jones served as a consultant to the film Milk. Jones met Harvey Milk in the 70s. He worked as a student intern in his office and became an activist. He later went on to establish the Names Project AIDS Memorial Quilt. Here and Now's Renee Graham caught up with Cleve Jones in Boston recently. She asked him about this month's passage of Proposition 8, California's same-sex marriage ban, and how that compared to one of Milk's greatest political victories, which was the defeat of Proposition 6. That would have banned gays and lesbians from teaching in California's public schools.
If he were here today, what would Harvey Milk have done differently in the days and weeks leading up to the Prop 8 vote?
I think Harvey would have run a very different campaign. In Prop 6, we had thousands, literally thousands, of openly gay and lesbian men and women going door to door in every precinct saying, "I am gay, please do not vote for this, it will hurt me." This campaign relied on television ads paid for by black tie dinners, and it was not an effective strategy. I think perhaps more importantly is what would Harvey Milk have us do now that we've been defeated. And I think that while with this film coming out, it's inevitable that people will look back into 1978 for inspiration, I think what they should really do is look back to 1964. As the civil rights movement was moving forward, and it became clear that the southern states and many others would probably never consent to full equality for African American citizens, it was then that the Congress and President Johnson, after being pushed and prodded by Dr. King and other leaders from the civil rights movement, passed the Civil Rights Act, which ensured equal protection under the law in all areas in all 50 states. That, to me, is the strategy that we should be employing now.
Taking into account that Milk is a film, not a documentary, how accurate is its depiction of Harvey Milk, but also by extension, 1970s San Francisco?
It's very accurate. I knew Harvey Milk well. I know Sean Penn. When I watch this film, I forget it's Sean Penn. The editing that goes back and forth between archival footage. I was there on set every day, and I find it hard to figure out which is archival and what did we shoot there. So it's astonishingly real.
You're wearing a suit.
I got it from a friend.
No. You, at any time you come here, I want you to wear the tightest jeans possible. Never blend in and never take the elevator. Always use the stairs. You can make such a grand entrance by taking these stairs.
Was it eerie for you watching the film and seeing Harvey, and also seeing Emile Hirsch portraying you? What's it like to see someone portraying your life on screen?
Well, the whole experience was very eerie and poignant and sad and funny. Through much of the archival footage, of course, I see the faces of many of my brothers and sisters who are no longer here. As for Emile, this is Cleve Jones, and I endorse this portrayal. I should also say that I was briefly that cute.
Well, I was about to ask, when the first time we see Cleve Jones in the film, he's really lippy, he's really outspoken, he's just on the brink of being obnoxious.
That was very generous of you. I thought I was quite obnoxious.
And you say that's accurate.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You knew Harvey Milk. You knew Harvey Milk very, very well as a friend and as also a fellow activist. What was it about him that so attracted him to such a wide variety of people, just outside the gay community, just so many different communities. What was it about him that attracted people to him and to the causes that mattered to him?
Harvey Milk was the most genuinely empathetic political figure I've ever met. We're so accustomed to politicians who can put on the right facial expression and maintain significant eye contact and say all of the right catchphrases. But Harvey truly loved people. He truly loved his city. He loved all different kinds of people and was comfortable talking to a rich white lady from Nob Hill, and then he could go and talk to hippies. He could talk to gay street kids. He could talk to black people and Latino people and Asian Americans and Teamsters. And in every encounter, you could just sense that he was enjoying it. It wasn't fake.
It wasn't just the politics of the moment. It was he really wanted to get to know these people and what their concerns were.
Exactly, and that was a very important lesson for me because at the time I hated straight people. I was very heterophobic. This was born, of course, of fear because I had been abused quite badly in school. I wanted to live in a ghetto. I wanted to build the walls around the ghetto to keep straight people out. And then I start working with Harvey and suddenly have to cross all these boundaries and go with him to the senior citizens' bingo nights and the union halls and the bus stops in every neighborhood in town where all different kinds of people would come up to him with all different kinds of issues. And he had such a knack for making some self-deprecating, silly little remark and get people to relax and then begin looking for that common ground. What is it that you and I share? I was not that excited about electoral politics and working within the Democratic Party, but it was Harvey who convinced me of the importance of having our people elected into public office.
There she is.
Who the heck is that?
That's our new campaign manager. She called last week to volunteer, and I asked for her help.
Help her take over.
What about Scott? We need new blood. Gentlemen, Ann Cronenberg, a woman. A woman who likes women. And that's odd, isn't it?
Hi, guys.
Could you talk a little bit about Harvey Milk as the pragmatist? He wasn't just this sort of dreamer who envisioned a beautiful world. He really understood how to work the system, didn't he?
Harvey had, I think, an instinctive knowledge of how to work the system, work the media. And also, he was older than the rest of us. We were mostly a ragtag band of very young people. Harvey was born in 1930. He was a Jew born in 1930. So when he was coming of age, it was during the height of the Holocaust. And so I think there was a maturity to him that helped channel our youthful exuberance and radical rhetoric into language that was more accessible. This was, I think, one of the most important lessons I learned from him. Another thing about him that I want young people to understand is that Harvey Milk, in most respects, was a very ordinary man. His personal life was often in disarray. He was penniless when he died. He, in his life, endured all of the setbacks and humiliations that so many of us endure. But because he did love his city and he did love his people and he was courageous and he did speak the truth, and so he had an enormous impact on the city and the state and our country and the world.
Gay activist Cleve Jones speaking to Here and Now's Renee Graham about his mentor, the late Harvey Milk. The film Milk opens in selected cities this week. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young will be back tomorrow. Please join us again here and now.